Rolling Stones from 1978, the Some Girls album, the song being the When the Whip Comes Down. That's a good one. We switch gears now to talk about UFOs. You'll recall, students of the subject will recall, that in 1969, the U.S. Air Force announced that Project Blue Book had come to an end. The Air Force told us there's no evidence that UFOs pose any kind of threat to national security, so there's no use continuing any kind of a study, as if Project Blue Book was a study anyway, more of a PR exercise, I think, explaining away UFOs rather than figuring out what they are. So Project Blue Book came to an end. Officially, the U.S. government was not collecting any information on UFO cases anymore. So then the public is left to ask, what about cases where there are intrusions over sensitive areas? Wouldn't that qualify as a national security case? For example, in 1975, a series of intrusions were reported at multiple U.S. military bases along the U.S.-Canadian border. And most of these places had nuclear weapons storage facilities. So you would think if anything qualified as a national security matter, that would do it. There were actually hundreds of classified documents about those intrusions that were stacked in UFO files within the military complex. Eventually, the public got to see some of them, but not all of them. Some intrepid UFO investigators here in the U.S. and around the world have squeezed those documents out of our military and have done some great analysis, and some of the best work has been done by my next guest, Paul Dean. He's an Australian researcher who focuses on government and military involvement in response to the UFO phenomena. He worked alone basically for 20 years on this stuff, but learned so much about how it works, how it worked in his home country of Australia, and how it works here in the U.S. And some of the work he's done is it's made him kind of a legend in UFO circles, and he is going to be joining us for his first time ever on Coast to Coast right after this. Paul Dean is an Australian researcher and writer who focuses, as I mentioned, on government and military involvement with the UFO phenomena. He's become a specialist in squeezing various documents out of not only the Australian government and military, but the U.S. government and military as well. He believes there are likely hundreds of thousands of UFO records still held somewhere within the bowels of the U.S. government. He and his team have acquired something like 240,000 pages of UFO-related government records from around the world. And Paul, who is making his first appearance here on Coast to Coast, I can only imagine what your house looks like, because I know what mine looks like, and I don't have nearly that much stuff. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how's it going, George? So for anyone who doesn't know, I am Australian, and you will tell that by my accent. I hope I'm easy to understand. I do start to talk very quickly. Sometimes my slang can be a bit hard to grasp, but there's absolutely I've studied the world's governments, and when I say government, I mean military commands. That's air forces, armies, navies. In your case, the Marine Corps as well. Intelligence community agencies, civil flight agencies, transport agencies, and even government-funded universities and so on. I've studied their response to the UFO conundrum since I was 13, and I'm now 38. So I've studied everything. I mean, everything from the early Directorate of Air Force Intelligence studies and intelligence estimates on UFO reports at the Pentagon in 1947 through to, you know, the way Edward U. Condon ran his so-called UFO study team at the University of Colorado for the Secretary of the Air Force as Blue Book was closing, to, you know, to the air defense ground environments, squadrons of the United Kingdom, how they've responded to unknown tracks in British airspace in the UK defense region, through to, you know, Australia's joint intelligence organization's response and evaluation of unidentified flying objects as reported to Australia's Directorate of Air Force Intelligence in the 70s, on and on and on and on. And I've built up quite a specific knowledge of how documents are created, how documents are formulated, what they say, what they mean, how they can be analysed in hindsight, who signs off on them, chains of command, reporting channels, whether it's semi-automated reporting channels for UFOs by pilots, through to naval speed letters, etc., etc., etc.
I should mention, Paul, that although that sounds kind of dry, the stuff that you have mastered now, the terminology, the abbreviations, acronyms, it's all really valuable because it helps you track down where this stuff is going, who is involved, who reads these documents, and what it means. I mean, it helps you interpret it in terms that regular people can understand, right?
Yeah, it is extremely dry. Some people, most UFO buffs or UFO enthusiasts find what I do extremely complicated, sometimes very, very archaic and boring. And it is, to get your head around it, for instance, the organisation in Australia that manages airports and navigation and air traffic control is called Air Services Australia. Now, a pilot can submit a UFO report on something called an electronically submitted event report, ESIR, which is a type of online document that a pilot would write out, you know, time, date, location, his license number, the model of plane, the airline he was flying with, and so on. Then write a narrative of a UFO sighting. Now, you've got to know first, before you start, say, asking Air Services Australia within the Australian government, before you start asking them for any UFO reports filed by pilots in the last 10 years, you have to know that UFO reports are submitted by pilots using ESIR forms. Now, that takes a lot of work, a lot of phone calls, a lot of sneaking around, a lot of sneaking and skulking around, aviation magazines, airline magazines, flight safety records, talking to the right people, ringing air traffic controllers, contacting people on Facebook and so on. So to find out, everyone understands, everyone's got access to, say in your country, to Project Blue Book files at Maxwell Air Force Base or National Records and Archival Center, Records Administration in Washington. Everyone's got access to old stuff, but what I specifically wanted to do is get access in Australia and America and now the United Kingdom to new stuff that no one has ever seen, or go back to old stuff that other people got out of the government 30, 40 years ago, which was never evaluated properly. That's what I do. So, but I've got no doubt from what I see from distribution lists and the way military documents are written, particularly about UFO reporting, I've got absolutely no doubt that there has to be hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pages of UFO reports, evaluations, investigations, draft press memos, briefs, commanders' briefs, point papers, discussion pieces, memorandums of understanding, etc., existing in the bellows of your government. No doubt.
And do you think that there is a gigantic storehouse, that there's a central keeper of this stuff, or it's dispersed all over the place?
Now, it's dispersed all over the place. We know now where it's dispersed, and the list is absolutely incredible. I honestly do not believe that there is one major United States government central repository for current UFO reporting, investigation, evaluation, assessment, classification, and so on. I just don't. Because the way, I believe there are many small sub-agencies and cells and squadrons that do directly deal with the UFO matter when it comes up, and I know some of them, and I can explain this tonight. We know in writing where they are. One would be NORAD's J3.
Yeah, we're gonna work up to that. I don't want to give the kicker away. We're gonna work up to that, and we're gonna learn some Australian slang along the way. Let me ask you this, I'll give you this this preamble. Is the reason I got hooked on the UFO topic, maybe it's the same one as you, is because of the government's response to the phenomena. It was as a reporter, it's something that I could follow, the paper trail, the kind of thing that you have spent the last 20 years doing. I'm really interested in flying saucers and things in the sky and strange craft, but as a journalist, I don't know when they're going to show up. I can't study that. But I could study the government's response to the phenomena, and that is every bit as interesting as whatever the ultimate mystery about UFOs might be. For me, it was something I could sink my teeth into, and it sounds like that's the same thing that appealed to this part of it to you.
Exactly. This is the thing. Most UFO researchers go down the path of accepting and looking at reports submitted by, you know, hyperactive teenagers about funny lights in the sky. We see no instrumented data like radar, like primary radar imaging or you know, magnetic anomaly detection or whatever. Most people simply study what comes out of people's mouths, and it's often anecdotal, embellished, missing key information, etc. And we have so many cases. You know, there are just, you know, hundred, you know, Michael Swords, Barry Greenwood, Fran Ridge of kneecap.org, you know, we have on file, like physically in PDF or actual manila folders, going back, I mean, APRO and like I said, Kneecap, we have on file, you know, like 150,000 UFO reports from around the world since the 40s. And, you know, I didn't want to just simply add another 10 or 20 a year to that pile. I wanted to specifically study why government agencies often had a 180 degree turn. I mean, what was interesting to me was that on one hand, you know, government agencies would simply say, look, this or that case can pretty much be explained by, you know, the rising of Venus through a layer of pollution over this or that city, and then but in classified documents, you see some sort of 180 degree turn where they actually show top level concern and real confusion, and that total mismatch, and we see it in government documents all the time, that total mismatch from what they're telling Congress or House or the public or the press or journalists or each other compared to what they're telling their commanders in reasonably highly classified documents is what actually interested me. And so a few years ago I did study in complete isolation, and then a few years ago I thought I'd actually do something about it, so I started hounding the Australian and the US government, plus hounding researchers of old who had done this sort of thing before. Barry Greenwood,
Larry Fawcett, Bruce McAbee.
Yeah, Lawrence Fawcett, he's deceased, unfortunately. He's great. Robert Todd, the greatest FOI requester in history. Bruce McAbee's not bad. You know, like that, I started working with them constantly, and I found these huge gaps that where we were missing key information that we knew had to be there. So that's what I've worked on, yeah.
Let's talk for a couple of minutes about Australia, how it compares to the U.S. in terms of its freedom of information or public records laws. How accessible this was, how hard it was to get information from various agencies or military, and then encapsulate what you were able to get from them.
Yeah, so what's interesting is Australia's government is nowhere near as safe, or the term be as bloated as yours. You know, like we have only two agencies that are responsible for air and flight safety and navigation and air traffic control. We have an Air Force, an Army, and a Navy, and it's all centralised within the Department of Defence. There is not wide FOI desks at every squadron and every battalion and every office and every agency and every inspectorate and directorate and secretariat. There is just one FOI desk at the Department of Defence, and then there's one FOI desk at the Australian Transport Safety Bureau and one FOI desk at Air Services Australia. So as far as centralisation for records and organisation, we are streets ahead of where you guys have ever been. However, there is much less to grab because Australia is a much less populated country. We've got less than 25 million people. You've got over 300 million. We've got far less planes in the sky, far less primary radar coverage. So the possibility that, say, an Army aviation helicopter or a naval fleet plane or an airliner going between Sydney and Melbourne, the chances of them seeing a UFO on any given day compared to, you know, some sort of unknown or straight aircraft or whatever, or a meteorite or whatever, the chances are so much lower. So our actual volume of information is much smaller. So it was dealing with the Australian government was much easier than dealing with the US government. And so what I started to do was I remember in one FOI request, I asked Air Services Australia to search ESIR, that's Electronically Submitted Event Report Database, their Electronically Submitted Event Report Database, for the keywords UFO, unidentified object, unidentified flying object, unidentified craft, strayed aircraft, etc. And they came back to me with pages and pages of stuff, and quite clearly, most of it was balloons and model aeroplanes. But, you know, one thing jumped out at me, which I'll tell you now. This was interesting. So I found they had a database called the Electronically Submitted Event Report Database, and they actually printed out, under the FOI Act, they actually went through the database digitally with keywords, and they found all cases submitted since... all cases submitted by pilots, like Australian civil pilots, this is not military, this is civilian pilots, airliner pilots and so on, all UFO, all reports of anything, any air safety issue submitted to Air Services Australia with the keywords unknown, UFO, etc. And there were a few really interesting hits. There was one that I've got where what happened was it was actually 1999, and... It was in June. It was the 23rd of June, and it was at 7:15 at night. And there was actually two. Australia's very big, and there was two planes travelling between Darwin and Alice Springs. Now that in your country would be the equivalent of travelling between, say, Minneapolis and St. Louis, like we're talking dead south, you know, like north to south. And what happened was, I've got it right here in front of me. There was two planes, and they're behind each other, like one's in front and one's at the back, and the particular model of aircraft was called an Israeli Industries Westwind jet, and they travel at 39,000 feet, which is very high, or pretty high for an airliner. It's not a military plane, but it's not far off capability. And the pilots both saw something. They both saw something out the window for quite an extended period of time that looks like it dipped up and down in the atmosphere. And I'll read you what Air Services Australia gave me under the FOI Act. So the executive summary simply says, pilots of AJP and AJK en route for Alice Springs sighted an unidentified green object in their vicinities. No details of any other traffic held by Sector 11. Then in the descriptive section, it says, at 10:15, the pilot of AJP Tyndall for Alice Springs reported sighting a green object climbing and descending vertically and paralleling his track for some time. The pilot of AJK Darwin for Alice Springs reported sighting this green object as well. No details of any other traffic were held by Sector 11. Now, what that means is that Sector 11 means that in that particular part of Australia, there should be no other aircraft activity. There should be no military, all unclassified military flights. There was no airliner flights or private flights, particularly at that altitude. Now, helicopters don't get up that far. So you've got two pilots flying alone. You know, like one's in front, say, by 15 miles and one's at the back, and both see the same thing at the same time, same colour, dipping up and down and then flying parallel with one of the aircraft. Now, Air Services Australia were prepared to hand that over to me. And so that's a classic example of a very, very good government agency who only took, you know, it only cost me like $30 or whatever for the FOI request, because they are expensive. They've got to spend time going through databases and redacting information and emailing each other and then sending stuff to me and dotting I's and ticking boxes and whatever. So FOI in that respect is a very, very good source of information, you know, and I've done this heaps. I mean, I've had, for instance, an easy one was to actually ask our Royal Australian Air Force for their current policy on what happens if the media ring an Air Force base and ask about UFOs. And the actual document was called Royal Australian Air Force Administrative Instruction Media Handling Inquiries Miscellaneous. And it had a section about UFOs and so on. So I found it, unlike America, I found it very easy to get... Now, of course, we don't know what they're not telling us. I do know one train of information. The Royal Australian Air Force have a particular wing called 41 Wing that's based at Edinburgh Air Force Base in South Australia, and they run the world's most advanced over-the-horizon radar network. We can peer down on Indonesia anytime we want. And the Jindalee over-the-horizon radar network is a huge ionospheric radar that can track aircraft and ship movements all over, you know, all over above, in and above Australia. And I've actually used FOI to ask them for their documents that instruct Battle Space Command.
I'll tell you what, Paul, that music is telling us we need to take a break. We'll pick up that story on the other side. Poco, the quintessential Poco song from 1972, takes us into the break. We'll be back with more Coast to Coast AM in a moment. A little tune for the cowboys and cowgirls listening tonight in Pioneer Town, American icon and national treasure, Willie Nelson. My heroes have always been cowboys. Willie's still out there on the road, but has hit a few speed bumps lately. He was here in Las Vegas for shows, I think five shows over 2 weeks, had to cancel some of them, had to cancel some other dates as well because of illness. I'm just saying, we're sending some positive energy from Coast to Coast listeners to your way, Willie Nelson. Hope you're around for a long time and that you're feeling better. We'll be right back with more Paul Dean giving us the inside secrets, what he has learned from Australian military and U.S. military UFO files. Stick around. I mentioned a couple of minutes ago that back when I first started chasing UFOs, the UFO topic as a journalist, what interested me was the paper trail, the documents that you could follow, that you could get your hands on to get an idea about what military officials, government officials were saying to each other behind the scenes. You know, when the Freedom of Information Act became law here in the U.S. in the mid-70s, it opened up new vistas for UFO researchers. If you had asked, for example, the FBI prior to FOIA becoming the law of the land, hey, can you show us your UFO files? The FBI would typically respond, we don't have any UFO files. We've never studied UFOs. And then after FOIA became the law, they had to release something like 2,000 pages. Same thing with the CIA. Paul Dean, I'm sure for you, what is most interesting is what these folks, the military folks, say to each other behind the scenes. And before FOIA was the law of the land, they had to assume that these documents, these memos and reports about UFOs would never be seen by anyone outside the military. And that's some of, I think, the most compelling evidence there is.
Yeah, and I know, look, I've studied in the 70s, the combination of the CIA, NSA, DIA, FAA, and FBI, and a couple of others like Air Force Weather and so on, released, and this is not even including the releases regarding the 1975 overflights, which you talked about briefly when you started, but those agencies released to Barry Greenwood, William Spaulding of Ground Saucer Watch, Robert Todd, Lawrence Fawcett, Todd Zeckel, Larry Bryant, they released just under 3,000 pages of documents that were mostly dated after the close. You know, a lot of them, a good half of them were dated after the closure of Project Blue Book. Now, you know, the Secretary of the Air Force on, I think it was, Secretary of the Air Force, Robert J. Siemens, said in 1969 that no government agency in the United States was going to be handling UFO reports anymore. And yet we see documents, you know, by intelligence collections memoranda and actual raw intelligence from the National Security Agency. We see the CIA's operations desk and foreign bureau collecting UFO reports from embassies and through local newspapers in the Eastern Bloc nations and China. We see the Defense Intelligence Agency handling incoming Project Moondust memoranda and UFO sightings from the Middle East, such as the infamous Tehran incident, in what they call joint message form format. We see, so there was no doubt what Robert C. Siemens actually said on the 17th of December 69 was no UFO reported, investigated, and evaluated by the Air Force was ever an indication of threat to our national security. So why then were military agencies or military-leaning intelligence agencies still hyperventilating over UFO cases, you know, after the closure of Project Blue Book? And we saw that particularly in 1975. Do you want me to explain what I found out about the 1975 overflights that hasn't been looked at before?
Yeah, we are going to go into that. Before we get to that, I want to ask you one more question about Australian records. Is there anything that you would consider to be sort of a smoking gun, any kind of a report from the Australian military or agency or government in which it says, something the equivalent of, these UFOs are from somewhere else. They're not ours. They're beyond anything that we have.
No, not at all. I do have that. There was one memo written in 1971, and okay. So in a, there was a couple of things that are very interesting. They certainly don't say allude to what you suggested, but there is something interesting. It's more from where these came from. Now we had in the 50s we had an organization called the Joint Intelligence Bureau, and in 1970 or maybe 1969 it changed its name and widened in scope to it was then called the Joint Intelligence Organization, JIO, and in 1992 it changed to the Defense Intelligence Organization, DIO. Anyway, the director. Now, the old JIO was very much like your CIA. It was an internal and external, all source, all materials intelligence. It's human intelligence, imagery intelligence, foreign intelligence, spying, defense, foreign assessments, and so on. It was an all source intelligence, very widespread intelligence organisation here in Australia, and it was answerable directly to the Prime Minister of Australia and the Attorney General and the what you would call the National Command Authorities. Very, very, very secretive organisation. And in 1971, the actual director, now this guy's probably, you would think, got better things to do, but the actual director of the JIO, who was Robert W. Furlonger, he wrote in a 27th of May 1971 memo, it was to his secretary for the file, he actually wrote a memo, and in it, now remember, this guy's directly answerable to your equivalent, or our equivalent of your president. He actually wrote in a memo, further to our discussion on the question of investigation of Australian reports on unidentified flying objects, I would summarise my attitude as follows. There appears to be sufficient evidence from the Royal Australian Air Force and US reports of investigations of UFO sightings to indicate that there are some reports which cannot be readily explained by natural phenomena or man-made activities. Now, for a person who's in a very, very guarded role, who has to be very, very careful what he says, because, people run around after this guy, so if he says something controversial, it's going to be major news to the Cabinet and to the National Assessments Office and to the Defence Signals Intelligence Agency, ASIO, whatever. So for him to say that was actually quite interesting. Now, another document, the only other example I can give you, which is really tantalising and it's much more modern, is, now, let's presume UFOs, as in, I don't mean just, unidentified planes and missiles and helicopters. Let's say UFOs are the real deal. They actually do exist. And if you study the Blue Book files or whatever files, the reports are consistent enough that, UFO reports do appear at squadron level to air traffic controllers and above warships and so on. Let's say that they appear on primary radar, which Blue Book alone has 3,000 primary radar or radar visual cases. Let's say they appear on primary radar and everything tells us that they do. You would think then that modern primary radar systems, the best in the world, long range, high frequency, with all the computerization and filters and image enhancement and so on you would need, you would think that they would still be appearing on radar. Now, I asked the Australian government, I said point blank to the Directorate of Coordination for the Royal Australian Air Force, does anyone at 41 Wing watch Australia's skies for the military, does anyone at 41 Wing have any instructions or manuals or regulations or mandates or edicts to track truly unidentified flying objects? That's objects that aren't responding to radio signals, which are clearly suspicious in behaviour, behaving weirdly, whatever. And she actually came back to me and she said, yeah, we actually do. And she said, we actually govern the picking up of unidentified contacts, like on radar. So we've got these battle centres in Australia with these huge screens that look down on all the airline flights and all the missile tests and all the balloons and flocks of aircraft and Indonesian aircraft and Papua New Guinean aircraft, and we look down on anywhere we choose to, and we're very, very good at it. Now, they said to me that the actual process of watching an unidentified aircraft is called the contact of interest reporting process. processed. So there we've got a new name for airborne oddities or airborne aircraft that aren't, you know, that aren't readily identifiable within, you know, a few minutes. So they're called contacts of interest. And I said, okay, I want the actual instruction, the actual manual to Battlespace Air Traffic Controller, air traffic controllers within 41 Wing of the Royal Australian Air Force. I had the nerve to ask under the FOI Act. I said, I want the actual instruction. I want the actual document that tells air traffic controllers for the Royal Australian Air Force what to do when a really unusual radar target is picked
up. And did you get it?
I certainly did. Now, some of it was classified. Now, the actual document is called 41WG, that's 41 Wing, Standard Instruction Operations 03-19. And the title of the document is called Contact of Interest Reporting Process. And in it, so for instance, under definitions, it says contact of interest. A contact of interest is defined as any radar track which matches or potentially matches current 41 Wing tasking intentions. And, you know, like, just having a look at it in front of me. So recording of contact of interest details. So when a contact of interest appears on their big radar, they've actually got to record it on this special online form. And that online form, they put in where the contact of interest appeared on their radar, what direction it's going, azimuth and bearing and so on, what altitude it is, when it faded out, like if it did fade out or vanish, how fast it was going, did it perform any unusual maneuvers, and it actually says here, recording of contact of interest details. The surveillance unit responsible for contact of interest will record all relevant details pertaining to the contact of interest. Annex A details the unit's responsibility and processes for recording, compilation, and storage of CIO details. Now, what's interesting is when you scroll down this document, when I got to Annex A, which would be an example or a blank template of how they record unknown aerial tracks or contacts of interest, that's the part that they actually redacted from me. So I can't actually see, they redacted under national security regulations, I can't actually see exactly what they record. Now, I do know from other documents that they record when it appeared, when the object appeared on radar, when it disappeared, its azimuth, bearing, heading. But I don't know if they record things like a battle space assessment or things like if it's, say, split into two pieces and then reformed, as some UFOs apparently have done. I can't see where the information goes. Like, does it go to Joint Forces Headquarters? Does it go to the Air Operations Battle Center? And I don't know how fast all this has to be done, because usually these instructions tell a battle space officer, you know, this needs to be done within 30 seconds and a commander's brief needs to be written in 5 minutes and then the whole thing has to be solved in 30 minutes or we scramble aircraft to shoot the thing down or whatever. I can't see any of that, and that's what I would like to see. But it's redacted. I can't see it. So that is quite tantalizing, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I would say so. Is there... is there anything else in the Australian files that you would say suggests that something weird is going on? Are they as forthcoming as, say, some of the, for example, the estimate of the situation type documents that have been made public in the American files?
No. You've got the lion's share, the famous documents like the Nathan Twining memo of 17 September 47, and the Colonel McQueen memo, and the Vandenberg letter, and the, you know, the infamous Belanda memo, the closed down Project Blue Book, and so you've got the best stuff by far. I've never really seen a document in Australia's government, whether it's in the military or in the civil flight agencies, air ministry, and so on. I've never seen a document that really says we're frustrated, we don't know what's going on, we're scared. You know, our planes are being harassed every day. I've never seen a document like that. Now, somewhere.
Let me ask you this. Could you describe sort of the relationship Australian military to U.S. military? I know we're allies. We work together. We've fought side by side in basically every war of the last century. But do your agencies, military agencies, take their cue on the UFO subject from American agencies.
They certainly do. And so what was interesting is that Blue Book, when your Project Blue Book was formed, for readers that don't know, the US military's study of UFOs started with Project Sign, then briefly Project Book Grudge, and then for 20 years was Project Blue Book, based at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. It was supposed to be an investigation. It was a whitewash. It was a public relations joke. You know, sometimes they did a good job. Anyway, Blue Book accepted reports from all over the world in letter form, air attaché memoranda, speed letters, service reports, submissions, telex submissions, teletype telex submissions, and so on. Believe it or not, it's quite interesting, actually. My friend Keith Basterfield, an Australian researcher, has just actually compiled this, but look, you know, once and for all in one PDF document. Australia's government, our Royal Australian Air Force and Department of Air, in the 50s mainly, and in the early 60s, we actually submitted UFO reports to Blue Book through the air attaché in Canberra. So when our Royal Australian Air Force had a report from a civilian or a pilot or a military source or whatever of some sort of unidentified flying object or something weird in the sky, just for a while there, Blue Book was more than happy to accept that, you know, being from a reasonably good source, because Australia, you know, we know what we're doing. We, you know, so Blue Book readily accepted a good 22 UFO reports from Australia over about a 14-year period. Now, most of them do, to me, look like meteorites, but some of them are a bit weird. But Australia's military do have very close relations with the US military. We train together. Our navies are completely interoperable under NATO auspices and under the Pacific Fleet. Your air attaché in Canberra and our air attaché in Washington are very busy places, and so, you know, it would not surprise me at all, is because the US supplies us with a lot of stuff, a lot of radar systems for our planes and the actual planes themselves and so on. It wouldn't surprise me at all if an F/A-18 Hornet, which is an American combat jet, which we have here in Australia, it wouldn't surprise me if a pilot or a pair of pilots picked up something on their forward-looking airborne primary radar, trackball scan radar. It wouldn't surprise me if not only we studied it in Australia at something like one of the security and electronic assessments branches within the DSTO. It wouldn't surprise me if the data was also sent back to the manufacturers, and maybe even somewhere like the Air Force Test Evaluation Center or whatever it's called, or the Air Safety Inspection Center at some Kirkland Air Force Base as well. You know, so there is that link. I couldn't rule that out at all. I mean, it is quite possible that any UFO activity in Australia that's been generally kept from the public and ministers and parliamentarians, you call them congressmen and senators, it wouldn't surprise me if there is some degree of sharing of information in the Pacific region. Yeah.
Do you have anything the equivalent of, for example, here, CIA and other agencies have monitored UFO researchers, infiltrated UFO organizations, disseminated disinformation, have really messed with the topic and purposely muddied the waters. Have you got anything like that in Australia?
Yeah, and not for a very long time. I've never seen a single shred of evidence, really, since 1984, and even then it was very small. There is a couple of examples in Australia's ASIO. We've got the Australian Security and Intelligence Organisation and our federal police, which is like your FBI. There are a few examples where Royal Australian Air Force or Department of Air or ASIO officers have been reasonably interested in Australian UFO groups, like civilian UFO groups, like, you know, think tanks and investigative groups. All the evidence to me, I know it's not very lurid for the listeners, but it just tells me, I've seen the paperwork and it really is quite downbeat. You know, we weren't talking about disinformation campaigns, counterintelligence campaigns, counterintelligence campaigns, bone tapping. We're talking about, you know, ASIO files saying, look, who are we monitoring this week in Queensland or, you know, New South Wales or Australian states? And you get situations where someone in ASIO or whatever would say, well, this...
I'll tell you what, Paul, we're going to have to take a break. I'll pick up that question on the other side, and then I want to ask you about the 1975 overflights, perhaps among the most dramatic UFO intrusions in American military history. Booker T. and the MGs take us into the break with Green Onions. We'll be right back.